Investment advisory services offered through Independent Solutions Wealth Management and Blackridge Asset Management LLC. Peak Broker Services LLC is not an affiliate of Independent Solutions or Financial Guys LLC.
Podcast, baby!
You're listening to the Financial Guys.
This is the sickness that is liberalism.
All these liberals love Bill Clinton. Let's put the budget back to where Billy was. Yeah.
People like Andrew Cuomo, people like Barack Obama, people like that have no business experience or skill whatsoever. These are the folks that are making regulations that you and I have to abide by. We need more Donald Trumps. That's what we need.
Here's Glenn Wiggle and Mike Lomas.
All right, welcome back, everybody. You got the Financial Guys podcast, a special edition today. We're really pleased to have Paul Meeks, who is a lead portfolio manager for the Wireless Fund. He's also on our investment committee for our very own Independent Solutions, where Paul is part of a, I guess, 170 years of investment experience we have on that committee. I do want to mention a few things before we get into today's podcast. I know a lot of people listen to our radio show as well on Saturday from 1 to 3 on WBEN and from 1 to 2 on WFTL. Saturday was a pre-tape show, just so everybody knows. So I wanted to mention that, kind of give you a little bit inside scoop. We get a number of phone calls at the office asking why we weren't talking about the Mueller report, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit this upcoming Saturday, but it didn't change from what we expected. We've been talking about Mueller probably finding no collusion, finding no obstruction. That's exactly what they found. We've talked about the Democrats not giving up, and that's exactly what happened. So I'm not sure if we're even going to talk about that again this Saturday, but we will be back live this Saturday, just so everybody knows. Today, Mike is unable to join us. He's actually traveling for business. We'll be doing another podcast later in the week on Friday to do our typical, you know, Mike and I podcast, Financial Guys, where money meets politics. Today, I thought we would talk just a bit about, focus specifically on money and even focus more specifically on the tech sector. Paul, I caught your interview this morning on Squawk Box on CNBC. Nice job. It was a fantastic interview. A couple of stocks you mentioned I want to ask you about here as well. But before I do, a little bit of your background, for those that don't know who Paul Meeks is, Paul was the lead portfolio manager for a number of Merrill Lynch tech funds between 1998 and the early 2000s. I think at one point you managed over $8 billion, the largest group of technology funds in the industry. You've been a frequent guest for 20 years on CNBC. I've watched you for years before I even had a chance to meet you and get an opportunity to work with you. So quite the history, mutual fund manager for a number of different companies, including Amana, Merrill Lynch, and a few others. So thank you so much for joining us. I certainly appreciate it. You've made a great name for yourself when it comes to technology.
Pleasure.
So you seem to be the go-to guy, which is fantastic. You mentioned a couple of stocks this morning that I think are reporting after the bell, if I'm not mistaken, both Facebook and Microsoft, right? They're reporting today, correct? April, what's the date today, 24th, for listener context?
At least within the next 2 days.
Okay.
The news is upcoming.
Okay. So Facebook, I've not been a fan of for a while. You know, you're on our investment committee, so I get a little bit more of the inside track. We get an opportunity to talk occasionally, and then monthly we do our investment committee meetings. We've talked about Facebook in the past. It's had a little bit of a recovery and a comeback off of the lows, but, you know, I've been kind of out of it for a while, but I was interested to get your take on what you're expecting when it comes to earnings this afternoon or tomorrow.
Yeah, the interesting thing with Facebook is they're actually going through a wrenching change because they've been criticized so much about the lack of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And they have 2.3 billion people around the world that tune in at least monthly. And of course, over time, those network effects, the fact that you can reach out to everybody in one fell swoop has been a big positive.
Mm-hmm.
But have the pushback with the inability to rein in hate speech and other things. And so they're actually going to switch to a more private model where through encrypted messages, you talk to a smaller group of friends. Now, you think about it, that is a 180.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little bit worried, and I'd like to have some more feedback on what this model is going to look like, not just as we speak about it, but financially before I get back in. So I've also been... I'm still in the stock, but I think, Glenn, right now it's just a hold because at no further notice, Wall Street analysts think that earnings per share growth is only going to be flat this year versus 18. And that's not the mark of a growth company, and that's not the mark of a tech company.
Right.
So they continue to grow their sales, but with all this extra spending to change the model to protect privacy, I think that's going to really impinge on their profits, and I'd stay away from the stock until I see how that all shakes out. As far as the quarter that they're going to report, I don't think they're going to report any surprises, either plus or minus Wall Street expectations.
Switching gears for a second, you know, kind of in the same realm, Twitter reported quite better than expected earnings. I think that was yesterday after the close. I was kind of surprised, to be honest with you, because it seems like I'm on Twitter a lot. That's my favorite platform to use when it comes to social media for the financial guys. I like the political stuff on Twitter. But Twitter's got, like Facebook, has gotten a lot of pushback because they've been, you know, canceling people's accounts. One of the most notable folks, Laura Loomer, who is the kind of, I call her a guerrilla journalist, you know, in that style where she kind of confronts people at their homes or things like that. But she does a good job breaking the story out. But they wiped her off completely, along with many, many other conservatives. So I was a bit surprised to see their numbers, you know, come out better than expected. Were you surprised by that, or was that something you had expected or anticipated?
No, I was surprised. And Twitter, who had been at least financially given up for dead a couple of years ago, and also Snap, which had been a really horrible broken IPO, both of those companies, both social media, I'd say second tier firms, not first tier firms, are with the number of users of a Facebook. Both of those companies, as you said, Glenn, have had a little bit of a comeback. Both companies, their last couple of quarters, have shown a reacceleration of growth, which actually surprised me quite a bit. I think long term, I don't know about Snap or Twitter financially. I think if you stay in social media, I would go, even if you may not like them, with Facebook. I just don't know if long term, financially, we have good enough business models for both Twitter and Snap.
Well, the thing about Snap that I don't get personally, and this is just, I guess, you get to a certain age, you know, my teenagers are using it. So I have, you know, one daughter in college, one that just passed her driving test today with a perfect score. So
yay!
Shout out to Emma. Congratulations to her. But I don't get this whole Snap thing. My daughter was showing me a picture the other day of somebody who sent her, you know, a picture on Snap. She goes, quick, before it goes away. Like, yeah. What do you mean it goes away? I understand.
Well, that's part of the magic over time. I think it was actually pretty novel. But I think what happens, Glenn, is Facebook through Instagram. And a lot of people don't realize that Instagram is a Facebook property. Mm-hmm. They can and have copied everything that Snapchat can do. And then the next thing that'll be very interesting for Facebook is they're going to try to monetize these Instagram users. And what they hope to do with their new business model is to get all these people that would go on the Facebook network to chat with their buddies. They now want to convert you into doing e-commerce on your phone through mostly Instagram, but other Facebook properties. So that is kind of the wave of social media with all these guys. They're going to try to monetize this user base.
You know, it seems like the, you know, the delivery of content is the most important thing, right? So, you know, you've got Facebook's acquisition of Instagram, you've got Google's acquisition, you know, going back a ways, of YouTube, which I think was a great move. I've been sitting back for years now wondering when Apple's going to make a similar acquisition. Now, I see Apple moving more into, you know, the you know, competing with the MasterCards, the Visa. I think that's going to be really what's going to drive a lot of revenue for them. But I don't understand why they haven't used some of this cash to buy up some of these younger companies that have some of this technology and just add it to their suite like Google and Facebook and so many others have.
You know, Glenn, that is a great question. I've said that for years. I think part of it goes back to the legacy of Steve Jobs. You know, even though he passed in 2011, the company has always had this culture of, if we don't create it, you know, through our own R&D lab, it's not worth much. And they have a huge war chest, over $3 billion, of which they could bolt on a lot of acquisitions, but they've been hesitant to do so. And I actually think it's a problem for them, because years ago, they could have made some great acquisitions. Like, I think over the time, they should have bought Netflix. Now it's too late. Netflix is too big. But now Apple's getting into video streaming, and they're coming from way behind when they could have made a lot of real simple acquisitions back in the day. And today they'd have a great services business that would complement their hardware iPhone business.
Right. Do you see anything out there
scrambling
today? Do you see anything out there today that could still be an acquisition target for them? Not that they would buy it, but just out of curiosity.
I think, you know, you mentioned this whole fintech with the credit cards. They did announce recently a venture where they're going to offer a credit card with Goldman Sachs. think they could continue to roll up some fintech plays, you know, payment processing type companies to go beyond that. I also think in video streaming, they desperately need content. They could buy somebody like an Electronic Arts to get into that space. And also, now that they've announced that they're going after Netflix with their own kind of Netflix look-alike video streaming service for movies and TV, you know, they could spend billions and billions and billions to build up their content library.
It seems, though, that that's already a somewhat crowded space, right? You got Amazon Prime. You know, my kids, for example, I look at what my kids are using. That's how I pick, you know, the things that I think, you know, I should invest in personally oftentimes, because they're the ones that are utilizing this stuff. So they have Netflix, they have Amazon Prime. That's predominantly what they watch. They don't watch cable anymore. You know, how companies like Time Warner stay in business, I don't know, outside of the monopolistic opportunities they have in different communities they operate within.
Yeah.
But you know, that's where my, so it seems as between Netflix, between Amazon and some of these other, you know, YouTube platforms, it seems like the space is already a bit crowded, you know, to try to force your way in. I don't know what makes sense, but again, that, you know, that's Apple for you. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think that they missed an opportunity to use their balance sheet to get more aggressive years ago when it mattered.
Right.
So you have Netflix. Now you have Apple in the game. Now you have Disney in the game.
Right. Disney as well.
You know, AT&T bought Time Warner. So Warner Media is going to have a video streaming service.
Right.
And Comcast, which is way behind the curve because people are cutting the cable, they're going to have their own video streaming service announced in the fall. So, man, you are going to have, with all these big, deep-pocketed firms, a nuclear arms race to build their content library fastest. And right now, you know, Netflix has an enormous lead.
You talked this morning as well when you're on Squawk Box and CNBC about Microsoft. You know, one of those stocks that, you know, I kind of wrote off years ago, but quietly, slowly but surely, it's made this, you know, when I saw the chart this morning, I was like kind of surprised.
Yeah.
As well as it had over the last number of years. I think you had mentioned the reinvention of more compete in the cloud space. And I wonder if you could just touch on that a little bit and what's really helped Microsoft turn the corner and change their business model to drive profitability.
Yeah, Microsoft is an amazing story. A lot of people falsely presume if you have a tech company that dominated paradigm, like Microsoft did with the advent of the PCs in the 80s and 90s, that switched to a new paradigm like the internet, that they're still going to be great. Mm-hmm. The guy who was a pro basketball player, just because he's a good athlete, to be able to play pro football tomorrow. But Microsoft actually did it. They dominated one space. The rules of the game changed, and they kept up. I give them a lot of credit, but a lot of it comes, Glenn, from in early 2014, they brought in a new CEO. His name is Satya Nadella, and the guy is an absolute rock star in my view. And he changed that company to a more of a cloud company versus a company where, you know, when you used to buy Microsoft's products, you would go to Best Buy and you'd pull off the shelf in a shrink wrap box, Microsoft's operating system, and you'd go home and you put the disk in your computer and download it. Now software is delivered on the cloud. And Microsoft is one of the leaders in the space with Amazon Web Services. And that company, because of that change, because they embraced that change, I actually think, hey, the stock is not cheap, but whenever it dips, because they are a leader in cloud computing, you got to buy it. I think it's, if you're a tech investor, it's a have to have on a bad day when the stock dips.
Right. You know, we're talking a lot about technology today, but, you know, for those that are not maybe aware of Independent Solutions, I would encourage you to, you know, check out that website, iswealthmanagement.com. Also thefinancialguys.com, where you can get links to these different things. We have an investment committee for Independent Solutions, which you sit on. A lot of what we do is asset allocation. So we're talking about the one sleeve, which is the more aggressive sleeve in the technology. I had a client, or not a client, but a caller call the radio show recently and say, I'm thinking about putting, you know, 100% of my portfolio in the, what do they call it? The FANG stocks, the Facebook, the Amazon. And I had to remind them that although good companies, you know, if I recall, when I started in the business back in the 90s and working for Payne Weber, AOL was all the rage, right?
So, yeah.
These things go out of business. They go away, yeah, no matter how good, yeah, the business model might seem at the time. And so diversification, I just want to put that plug out there, is always very, very important. So please consult an investment professional before going out and buying these stocks or whatnot. You know, we do this for a living Monday through Friday. It's easy for you and I to have these conversations. You're a chartered financial analyst, so the doctor of finance, so to speak, when it comes to this stuff. But I think a lot of investors hear things on CNBC, podcasts, radio shows, go out and want to buy those hot stocks in the news. And I think sometimes having a balanced portfolio, well, all the time, having a balanced portfolio makes a lot of sense. So for more information, always visit our website, financialguys.com, or you can always call our office as well. To switch gears for a second, there's, you know, two stocks I want to talk about. I'll circle back with a second, which is, you mentioned this morning, which is Tesla. But a Vimeo or Venmo or whatever this is called. Kelsey's probably laughing behind the scenes, but is it Venmo? The new,
it's Venmo.
Yeah. Venmo. Okay. I just saw something recently that where they're coming out now with a credit card, which to me seemed completely counterintuitive. So kind of circling back to talk about the data, not the data processing, the you know, transaction processing business, the Visa, the MasterCards, the Apple, which I think is a big, you know, a thing for them. It seems kind of counterintuitive that a company that has gone to an app would have any interest in going back to a credit card. That seems like a car company going back and reinventing the horse and buggy. I don't know.
Yeah, no, Glenn, another very good point. So Venmo, which is how I send my kids their allowance dough every month, is a great app. It is owned by PayPal. Mm-hmm. Now, PayPal is a publicly traded company that you may know from several years ago. It used to be eBay, mm-hmm, but eBay a couple of years ago split into the old or original auction business and then this fintech business, which is PayPal. So I own the stock in the wireless fund. One of the problems with Venmo, even though it's growing like a weed and they now have about 30 million subscribers, it's really cool, it's really convenient, is they've had problems monetizing that service. And you're absolutely right, Glenn. When I read the announcement that they're going to try to monetize all these people by issuing either Visa or MasterCard back credit card, I'm thinking, aren't there about a billion of those?
Right.
I actually think it's kind of disappointing, and they got to figure out a better way to take this fintech company, which they may split off into its own company at some point, and really show me a profit driver, because that ain't it.
So PayPal initially was founded by Elon Musk, correct? Is that right?
That's right. That's right. Sold it to eBay. Yep. eBay spun it off because it didn't make sense to have a internet business where you sold your old stuff out of your garage next to a fintech company. And so eBay trades and PayPal trades separately. Of course, I think PayPal is pretty cool. eBay is, you know, that's one of those yesteryear internet stocks.
Yep, that's the AOL of the last decade, right?
So that's a good, I agree, that's a good a good description.
Portfolios, yeah. PayPal definitely is a stock we own in a number of portfolios. You know, that on Independent Solutions.
Yeah, I think they're going to figure it out. They're very well managed.
So getting to Elon Musk, you know, my favorite person to hate, I think Elon Musk is just like Al Gore. I think he's the snake oil salesman of this century. He has done a masterful job of using other people's money along with his own, but a lot of government money to go on these, I'll call them follies. I mean, some of the stuff that he comes out with, now mind you, he's gotten, you know, smacked a couple times by the SEC for releasing stuff on Twitter. It seems as if, unfortunately, depending on the side of the political aisle you're on, you get away with it or you don't get away with it. He seems like he's going to get away with it based on, you know, the political flavor he's aligned with. But when it comes to the management of the company, I mean, it seems as if, I mean, the cars are cool. I mean, if you're willing to spend $80,000 on a car that might not be here in a year, but from a manufacturing perspective, a delivery to service, I don't understand. Now, mind you, I'm not a CFA. But I don't understand how the Wall Street values this stock anything over $10 a share. It's $284 a share today. It's ridiculous.
It's preposterous in my view. And I think one of the reasons that Wall Street supports it, and one of the reasons you want to have, you know, independent financial advice like ours, Glenn, is that Tesla burns through so much cash and they have such a voracious appetite for capital. They're an awesome client for the investment banks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Need bond and stock offerings. So on Wall Street, if you are a good investment banking client, you're going to tell your analyst to support the stock because you never want to anger an investment banking client who pays big fees. And so I think they're all sucked into this thing. And it's really a pity. It blows me away. This company is not particularly new. They've been around for 15 years. And rarely make money. They lose at about $1 billion per quarter clip. And then yesterday, I think what Elon Musk did, you know, they had this big to-do at their headquarters in Silicon Valley, and he made yet another preposterous claim. It just can't possibly come through, in which only a year from now, which isn't that long on the timeline, that Tesla is going to have 1 million in the United States robo-taxis. You have a vehicle that you buy from Tesla. Then when you're not driving it, you go on your Tesla app and you make your car available for somebody to rent. And when they rent it, they will pay a fee. Some of it goes to you and some of it goes to Tesla. So it's kind of a hybrid car manufacturer and rideshare company like an Uber or Lyft. But it is just a half-baked idea. I can't believe that anybody could possibly believe it. But of course, even the Wall Street analysts may not believe it, but they support it in print because they don't want to anger an investment banking customer. I think Elon Musk is a wonderful visionary, but I don't think he should be the manager of a publicly traded company because he's very dangerous. And if it was you or me, Glenn, we'd be fired a long time ago for all this stuff that he has said and the way he's pushed back against the SEC.
Yeah, no doubt about it. What I don't understand when it comes to Tesla is, you know, how the SEC allows him to continue to get away with some of this stuff. Because again, if it were you or me, you know, we would definitely, it'd be a different story. We'd be singing a different song and definitely having different conversations. You know, when it comes, I don't even think, even if he had the demand for a million taxis, I don't think he's got the manufacturing wherewithal to deliver those, even if he had that opportunity.
Yeah, I think what he does, Glenn, is when he gets in trouble, and you know they're going to announce quarterly results tomorrow, they're going to post a pretty big loss, and so he has this event like yesterday. So 2 days before the nasty quarterly results, he has a shiny object event to kind of distract, and that's what it's all about. Because this quarter will probably be pretty gruesome, and we'll have to go back to unsuspecting folks and take more money for them to continue to essentially invest in this money loser. They have a very cool product, but operationally and financially in serious jeopardy.
You know, you mentioned the analysts, and you're right when it comes to the support that Tesla receives. But, you know, we've both been in the industry a long time. You've 30 years of more experience than I have. But, you know, I recall being at Payne Webber and, you know, the wirehouse back in the late 90s where, and again, I was very young in the industry at that time, my mid-20s. And, I remember them pushing WorldCom, you know, and there was a secondary offering coming out that just so happened to be that Payne Webber was underwriting that secondary offering, of course. And they came out with a very strong buy on WorldCom. The analyst came to the Buffalo office, the office manager pushed it. It was a big push to sell this IPO, strong buy in the stock. And I looked at the business model. You know, I had a degree in finance and minors in economics and accounting, so I wasn't any slouch even at my young age. And I just couldn't figure it out. So, of course, we didn't buy any, fortunately. And, of course, that turned out to be, you know, Enron, Global Crossing, kind of falsified, you know, Fannie, Freddie, you know, cook in the books type of scenario. But after that, and after the dot-com bubble burst that we both went through, you obviously at a higher level than me being at Merrill Lynch and managing $8 billion in funds, but there was a lot of regulation that changed that was supposed to put these firewalls between the underwriters at one side of the business that were, you know, underwriting these new offerings and the analysts. Are you saying that that is now melted into, you know, the way it was, you know, 20 years ago, or is there still that firewall that provides some level of protection, or was there never, that firewall never really go up between the underwriting side and the analyst side?
That's a great question, Glenn. What I think has happened, and unfortunately the bad guys are very smart and very aggressive, and they're always two or three steps ahead of the regulators. So the regulators are always chasing after the carnage has always already occurred, not ahead of it. So that's just the kind of way it goes. I do think that there are, and they call that a Chinese wall, you know, between research and investing. I do think that that has been erected. And I do think that we have fewer situations like you described with WorldCom and Enron, where there was out and out accounting fraud. We do have less of that, but at the end of the day, always these guys are going to be able to sneak through the cracks. So, you know, maybe you catch 90% of them in the sieve, but 10% always get through. So to answer your question directly, better than it had been, particularly in eliminating financial frauds, accounting frauds, but it still unfortunately exists. It's just the nature of the beast.
Right. So this is where, you know, after that experience, you know, a couple of years, you know, working at Payne Webber, when I went independent, we started our own independent office for the financial guys. I switched the way we did research. Now, I don't manage stock portfolios anymore. I mean, I'm still on the investment committee, and I enjoy participating with you and John Thur and Dave Mariacher and the gang. But you guys are certainly smarter than I am when it comes to making decisions on asset allocation and stock picking and stuff like that. But I, you know, I learned to be very cautious of some of these analysts and what those hidden agendas are. And that was a early lesson in business. You know, what you didn't get in college, that was kind of the hard knocks of learning on the fly. Yeah. That, you know, take everything that you read with a grain of salt, because everybody who's writing or producing or something has some sort of a oftentimes agenda when it comes to, you know, the things that they're covering or what they're putting out there. So, you know,
that's a very good point. And I teach university finance investments, and I tell my students that, hey, even when Professor Meeks is speaking, mm-hmm. understand the bias. Because everybody has some bias, and some people are more objective than others. Yep. One of the things that you can do, Glenn, for your clients, and we do this, is that when you take a look at a publicly traded stock, it is pretty easy just to Google on the internet and find out who their investment bankers are. Mm-hmm. For example, were the investment bankers on the last time that they raised some debt or equity? And so you know among the Wall Street firms who potentially is on the payroll. So maybe if 10 companies cover a company, you eliminate the three investment bankers and start to read at least more of the research of the other seven.
Right, and good point.
To miss any of it, of course, the other seven also, you know, are vying for investment banking business, but the lead investment banker really is going to be too cozy with management.
That's a good way to look at it. That's an easy thing. Google and Yahoo are such nice tools to look at. So yeah, that's a good point. You know, look at who's doing the underwriting and maybe just discount that analyst and look at some of the other independent ones.
That's right.
I know you as a chartered financial analyst do a lot of fundamental research in the stocks that you're looking at. Really get to know the management and the CEO and the earnings and whatnot. After that experience for me, I went more of the Chartist way. So I went more of the IBD kind of still looking at earnings and things like that when I was managing money personally, you know, years ago. But I thought, I always found that the volume and the charts, you know, were kind of the unbiased view that where I can make my own decisions as opposed to necessarily listening to, you know, what somebody said. I'll never forget a quick story. In the 90s, we had, Payne Webber, retail analyst. They came out with a unit investment trust back then called Analyst Best Calls. They called it the ABC Trust. And I bought it, right? Personally, I sold it to clients as well because it made sense. It was like the Analyst Best Call. And they were going to tie like 50% of the bonus and the compensation for that analyst for that year was going to be tied to this, their best call for that year. And I remember the guy coming in for the retail sector, and he was really – you know, promoting the whole trust, but talking about his sector. And I can't remember what retail company he was talking about, but somebody asked a question in the advisors in the room and said, do you see this, you know, are they going to make any acquisitions or are they going to get bought out? Or it was one or the other. I think it was getting bought out. Are they a buyout target? No, I don't think so. They're a standalone. I talked to management. They're not up for sale. He literally left the office, was on the way to the airport. And I click on CNBC, and there's the announcement that this company was in the just accepted a bid or being bought out by somebody else. It was like, oh man. So unfortunately, the some of the things were already sold, and it is what it is. And it ended up not being so bad. It was like a 2-year trust. I think it made money over the 2 years. But
yeah, well, Glenn, you earlier in this podcast you raised a fantastic point that I think a lot of retail investors should take note of. You know, sometimes you'll see these products and they're kind of marketed like the all-star team. Right? You have the best pick from the retail guy, the best pick from the tech guy. But the most important thing in investing is not necessarily the stock picking, Glenn. It's, as you said, the asset allocation. And so sometimes they cobble together these portfolios, and there's going to be a time where you don't want to have even the best retail stock because that's an underperforming sector.
Right.
That's where your financial advisor comes in and helps with the asset allocation, because that might be a more important choice. Because, you know, sometimes with these all-star products where they have everybody's picks, you know, your pick could be the best house in a really bad neighborhood, and you don't want to be in that neighborhood. So the asset allocation, you know, coming from the level that we do it at our firm is very, very important. It eliminates some of these biases.
Yep, absolutely. That's a great point. And of course, you know, going through the tech wreck, if you recall, you know, companies that you couldn't give away in the 90s. So as a retail broker in the 90s, you know, we're talking to people about maybe balance the Philip Morris with the AOL, maybe buy Procter & Gamble with the Microsoft, right? And it was like, no, why would I buy Philip Morris? I'm like, I don't know, 6% dividend, everybody smokes. I'm just saying, but, it was like trying to sell, that house in the bad neighborhood, right? It was trying to sell stuff that nobody wanted because they wanted all the tech stuff. And, you know, fortunately for us, taking that asset allocation approach and forcing people to do that, through ETFs or mutual funds or whatever, you know, we were very fortunate to kind of keep a balance throughout that time and, helped our clients really navigate, which I think is really important.
There's I know you're a football fan like me, Glenn, but there is a time to play offense. There's a time to play defense. And even within the technology sector, you don't have too many chances to play a defense because my stocks are volatile. But there's going to be time not to buy a single one. And so you want to be as defensive as you can and raise extra cash. And that is, everybody wants to talk about their next great idea, but nobody wants to talk about the money you saved on the downside. And that is probably more important to somebody's wealth, frankly, the sell discipline rather than the buy discipline.
Yeah, a very old and wise investor told me, one of my clients who has long since passed, he said the easiest way to make money is not losing it in the first place.
So I agree. You
got the proper portfolio. Let me switch gears for a second, then we'll wrap up. I know we're getting a little bit long, but and I'm blowing off the break here, Kels, just so you know, we'll just do it one segment. But when it comes to being a mutual fund manager, you're the lead portfolio manager for the Wireless Fund, which is WIREX, right? People can look that up. How do you handle cash flows? Because that's something that I think it's one thing to be a stock picker. It's one thing to have, a good stock list. But when you're a mutual fund manager, I think what some, investors don't realize is that you have to manage cash flows, right? You have cash coming in. Usually when the markets are doing well, you have cash going out, usually when your sector might be out of favor. So from the perspective of trying to, minimize downside, of course, given the fact that you're in a wireless fund, how do you, as a mutual fund manager, manage those ins and out cash flows? Do you keep some cash on the side? Do you have what is your specific sell discipline to raise cash in the event that you need to?
Glenn, that's a great point. When you do these model portfolios, the easy thing to do when cash comes in is to just sprinkle it around to all the existing names. The problem for me that is, and maybe I put myself in an administrative bind because I make it harder on myself than it could potentially be, but I can't just, nonchalant say, here comes some money and everything we have in the portfolio is going to get a piece. I take a look at every stock and I don't want to invest even in my favorite idea if it's too close to my price target. That person might get in and I might be selling it soon. So even though it is an administrative burden, handling the cash, as you mentioned, Glenn, is very tough, but I have a price target for every stock. And I am not willy-nilly going to throw in any money into something that's too close to that price target, even if I have a portfolio that has extra cash. And frankly, right now, my portfolio has a little bit extra cash because money has come in and I'm not comfortable with tech right now after its enormous run. Mm-hmm. Portfolio is up almost 30% year to date.
Right.
Environment in which stocks go up about 10% per year. We've done three times that and we're in the first quarter.
Right.
So I'm not comfortable. And I'm almost going to be honest with people and say, you know what? I'm the tech guy, but you know what? Find somebody else because I am not a good value right now.
Now on the sell side, you set a target when you buy a stock in the portfolio and then reassess it at that target or just automatically sell it when it hits that your specific target?
It's a mix. Always have a sell target because that sell discipline is more important than the buy discipline. When the stock reaches that target, and hopefully it's a good case scenario, you take a look at the business, and unless it's going to generate more earnings or cash flow than you originally thought, your original decision is probably the right decision. It's kind of like when you're in the supermarket and you see a shorter line at the checkout counter and you switch and ends up being a longer line. You don't try to force yourself to raise the price target. Unfortunately, they do too much of that on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. But if there is a chance that the stock has greater earnings power or cash flow, maybe I raise the target. If not, you know, you begin, if you don't eliminate the stock completely, you at least begin to trim back the position. Right? Say it's a 5% position of the portfolio, and then you start to scale out of it. It becomes a 4, a 3, a 2. So that's one of the things that we handle. But both incoming with buy limits and outgoing with sell limits, we're very price sensitive. Nothing is done at the market price.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it. Great job as well, again, this morning. Fantastic interview on Squawk Box on CNBC. We'll be seeing you next week at our peak event of the year. So you're our special guest speaker on behalf of Independent Solutions. So we're looking forward. We have about 100 people down in Florida from all over the country. So we're excited to have you down to address the group and sign some autographs and get some pictures taken with some of our advisors. So thank you for look forward to seeing you.
That's cool. Thanks.
So that's Paul Meeks, everybody. You're going to join us on Saturday as well. So I should mention that and actually we may open the phone lines on Saturday. We can't do it here in the podcast, but the Saturday show is for 20 years, Mike and I have done a live call and radio show with all kinds of guests, both in finance as well as political. We've had several congressmen on and gubernatorial candidates, and we may open the phone lines and give maybe some of our listeners an opportunity to ask their questions of you and see what your thoughts are there. So thank you so much for that. We'll talk to you probably about 1:15, 1:30 on Saturday, if that works, East Coast time. So for everybody who has not tuned into the show before, you can go to our website to find out more information, not only about the show and about our business, but really everything that we do, all our social media stuff and things like that. You can go to financialguys.com. So thank you again, Paul, for joining us. That's going to do it for us, folks. On Friday, we'll be doing another podcast, more of a traditional Money Meets Politics. Mike and I will be back talking probably a little bit about the Mueller report, probably a little bit about New York State and some of the other things that are going on across the country. Subscribe to our podcast. You'll get alerts whenever they come out. Thank you again for listening and have a great rest of the week.